Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This weekend, participants in Cleveland's 5K Foam Fest will hurl themselves down a 50-foot slip and slide, navigate their way past giant swinging lemons, and try to stay upright in the Chamber of Foam. Non-traditional races like this, often referred to as fun runs, have exploded in popularity over the past 5 years. In fact, fun runs had 40% more finishers last year than marathons and half marathons combined. So what's the magic? Joining us by phone from California is Media Director of Running USA. That's a nonprofit organization that tracks the growth of the running industry. Welcome to the show, Ryan Lampa.
Hey, it's good to be here, Ann.
For our listeners, if you want to find out more about some upcoming fun runs in our area, check the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. So, Ryan, when did fun runs emerge as a regular option?
Well, I would say about 5-6 years ago, when the mud runs, the obstacle type runs like Warrior Dash, a Spartan Race, a Tough Mudder, started to get traction through their great marketing. And then through word of mouth and social media, they exploded and grew all over the country into a national series. And then in turn, then other people saw that growth and said, well, we don't want to do a mud run. Let's come up with something else, like a color run where we throw powdered paint at people. And so that kind of snowballed. And so what ended up happening is this huge growth from basically in 2009, it was as far as finishers in these fun runs, was just over low six figures. And then by 2013, that had grown to 4 million finishers. I mean, that's explosive growth. That is quite incredible.
And it's not what we think of as the sort of athletes that would do the half marathons or the marathons.
No,
it's
an interesting cross section, meaning that from what we're hearing from these different series is that a good portion of their entrants, 50-60%, aren't runners in the sense that they run every other day or anything like that. There are more people that are doing that color run for the first time ever, or their first 5K, or that person who is into CrossFit and wants to be challenged by a mud run and obstacles and fire and barbed wire. And that's good for our sport because it's not a been there, done that runner on average. It's a totally brand new runner that wasn't in the sport a year ago, a week ago. But that color run or that mud run got them off the couch because it was something different. It wasn't your dad's 5K. You know, and there's something about that that is appealing to that new runner that wasn't there for their local 5K.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ryan Lampa. He's with Running USA. It's a nonprofit organization that tracks the growth of the running industry. We're talking about fun runs this hour. If you have a fun run experience, if you have a fun run you want to tell us about, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, you mentioned three of the kinds of fun runs that I'm really familiar with, the Warrior Dash, Spartan Race, and Tough Mudder. Those are popular with a lot of people who have done a lot of boot camp type things. But I'm also surprised, particularly at the Warrior Dash, how many people show up who not only have they not gotten off the couch, it looks like they haven't gotten out of bed. And, I mean, they look very unfit, and it was kind of concerning to me. What about them? On the other hand, they don't have to do the, at least in the Warrior Dash, they don't have to do the obstacles.
Right. So, yeah, the thing about it is that the appeal of these non-traditionals, as we call them, is that it has this element of play. And that play element is very powerful. And for those people that aren't necessarily as fit and the like, they just want to have the experience.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be out there with their friends, and they want to get muddy and dirty. And moreover, I think they also want to share that in social media, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. And that's what also has helped their growth, is that then their friends see that and say, wow, that looks fun. I want to check that out. And that's what's happened over the past 5 years, and why we've seen this huge growth since 2009 from, as I mentioned, in the low six figures to now 4 million finishers. I mean, it's really astounding. So on the social media front, these non-traditionals have tapped into our sport much better than the traditional road race, be it a 5K, a half marathon, a marathon, or anything in between. That local road race wasn't getting that person that you just mentioned off the couch.
Mm-hmm.
But that mud run, or that color run, or that foam fest, or that ugly sweater run did. And I think that's good because, one, those people prior to that event were on the couch eating Cheetos. Now they're at least out there moving at an event, having fun, and at some point, X percent of them may end up saying, you know what, maybe I should be a more regular run. That was kind of fun. And I would say a percent of those people will end up doing that local 5K that they hadn't done prior to that color run or that mud run. And I think that's very important because, like I said, that's a brand new runner. And, you know, any industry wants new customers. And so once you get that new customer in the door, if you treat them right, if they have fun, if there's something to tell their friends or a social media opportunity, that's going to help keep them in your industry better. So and that's happening. And the thing that's also good for our sport is as we looked at the growth of the non-traditionals, or I should say, of the traditionals,
mm-hmm.
they're not being impacted. For example, if you take out the non-traditional numbers from 2012 and 2013, the number of finishers in that traditional category of the 5K up to the marathon
mm-hmm.
was in 2013, 15 million finishers. That's an all-time high for our country. In 2012, it was 13.5. So that growth rate is 11%. So that's also a positive sign, too, that these non-traditionals aren't taking away much, if anything, from that local 5K or 10K or marathon on average.
And, in fact, could benefit in the long run if they get – that triggers a desire to run better the next time.
Exactly. And that's the I think the key for any sport, be it a running, tennis, cycling, is getting people out the door and off the couch. And the thing that is really impressive about these non-traditionals is they've done exactly that over the past 5 years, but in incredible growth numbers that mm-hmm. our sport has never seen, not in the first running boom or the second.
So what came first, the chicken or the egg on this? Because, I mean, it sounds like social media has a huge role to play in this as far as spreading it.
Well, the thing is if you have a great product or a great idea or a great event, obviously people have to know about it. And through social media in particular, for these non-traditionals, because of the imagery and the appeal and that just that, in essence, if you look at the Facebook presence of the non-traditionals, it is really staggering. You know, for example, that like Tough Mudder has just under 4 million likes. Spartan Race has 3.6. Warrior Dash, 1.3. And the Color Run, almost 3 million. We could not find one traditional a road race or series that had over 1 million. So,
wow.
So they were very good at marketing in social media, and then in turn, in essence, they became viral. And then those people that saw that Warrior Dash a gallery or that video, they then probably shared it with a friend or two who said, wow, that is, and they smiled, they laughed, they said, I want to check that out. And I and as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the keys here that they've also tapped into is this element of play. And all of us, I don't care who you are, in essence, part of us is still a kid. And there's something about getting dirty or just having fun and laughing
mm-hmm.
that is very contagious. And these non-traditionals have definitely tapped into I'm into that feeling, along with the social media component, and it has just it has had a huge ripple effect in their sector of the sport. But it's also, as I mentioned, I think it's helped the traditional side of the sport, that it's not being impacted in a negative way where they're losing numbers as far as finishers. And that's a good thing for a sport, is to find ways to keep it fresh. And here is another example.
Well, what where did this come from then? I think the Warrior Dash is a fundraiser for St. Jude's Children's Hospital. So did most of them start out as fundraisers?
Well, that I don't know, but the actual mud runs have been around for a while, and like one of the older series is called Muddy Buddy, and that goes back to 1999. You know, so that series is 15 years old, but it didn't grow at the level in those early years or in the first 10 years because of the fact of social media hadn't yet landed on the internet. And I think that's a good example. And then by 2009 was the first Warrior Dash. And the Warrior Dash, you know, went from one event with about 2,000 finishers. Then by 2013, they had grown to 600,000 participants in 50 events. And that social media component, I think, was very powerful. But also, you also have to put out a good product, too. And so if you have good marketing, and then people then do your event, have fun, and they tell their friends, it then helps sell your event then to that next a runner or that next participant or that person who last week was on the couch but now is doing that Warrior Dash in their hometown.
Are there concerns over safety?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously with the obstacles and the mud, and like there are concerns of safety, and there have been unfortunately some deaths in mud runs. But that's all, you know, they like any event that you want to have it as safe as possible. But also in turn, then those events, you know, have to, I think, have a higher level of safety because of the more likely chance of falling down, obviously, getting hurt, or worse. So there, those companies that insure those types of events now, of course, are, you know, crunching their numbers on the injuries and deaths, and their premiums are probably going to be going up because of the fact that there's so many of them, and there's now millions of people doing them. And but that's, you know, but in general, they are safe, and that, but unfortunately, in some cases, some people do get hurt.
So are we past the golden age then? Is it going to start pricing people out?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. That's what the sport doesn't know yet, or this sector of the sport, is where is this category going to be 3, 4, 5 years down the road? And there have been a couple of these national series that in the past 2 months went bankrupt. And so there may be a saturation point that's there now. Right now, we can't say that for sure. But also the a larger non-traditionals like the Warrior Dash and the Color Run have a huge beachhead, and it's very difficult to dislodge them. So,
what do you mean beachhead?
Well, they have a big foundation that they have from started from nothing, and now they have 600,000 finishers, or in the case of the Color Run, 1 million. And they have a brand known as the Color Run or the Warrior Dash. And so for those entities that want to get into their category, it's going to be tough, you know, because they're already established and they have a brand name. So, you know, it's that I think in general, unlike any new part of an industry, there is a point when it does get saturated and when the cost of entry and the risk goes higher, and unless you come up with a better mousetrap, which is difficult, which is hard to do anyway, but against the big boys, it gets harder and harder to do. So it's you know, a thing that is interesting from my standpoint. It, at our 2012 conference, Travis Schneider was a keynote speaker. Now Travis is the founder of the Color Run.
Okay.
And in his talk, he this is going now on a year plus since that time. He mentioned that at that time they were already looking at another series that was different from the Color Run, because they also thought, well, okay, what happens if our bloom fades? What happens if our numbers plateau? So they are also looking at, okay, what's going to be our next big thing a couple years down the road if the Color Run flattens out, or if it just, you know, goes backwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the people in this sector of the sport are looking at the future and thinking about, okay, how can we keep our current series fresh and bring in that new runner, and or is there a spin-off we can do on our current brand?
Ryan Lampa, lots to think about. Thanks for talking about it with us today.
It was my pleasure, Ann.
Ryan Lampa, he's media director of Running USA. That's a nonprofit organization that tracks the growth of the running industry. Wellness Wednesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 1900, the average American could expect to live about 47 years. Today, the average life expectancy hovers around 80. That means many of us, and more every year, have wrapped up a primary career with a good 20 years to go. In partnership with PBS, WOSU has launched a local application of a project called Next Avenue, which features contributions from local experts on the art of aging. On Thursday, July 24th, WOSU at COSI will host a discussion entitled Retiring Retirement, New Paths for 50 and Beyond. I'm the moderator for that event. I hope you bring your friends and join the conversation. There's sure to be plenty of food for thought, and I'm still trying to work on them about getting plenty of food. check out the link at WOSU.org/allsides for more information. Joining us now in the studio is Jan Allen. Jan is a life coach, speaker, and contributor to Next Avenue Columbus. Welcome back, Jan.
Thank you, Ann. Great to be here.
Also joining us is retired District Court Judge Cindy Lazarus. She retired from paid employment 2 years ago. Before that, she served as president of Columbus City Council, was judge on the 10th District Court of Appeals, and CEO of YWCA Columbus and Flying Horse Farms. That's a special camp for seriously ill children. She also is a Next Avenue Columbus contributor. Welcome back, Cindy.
Thanks, Ann. It's great to be with you.
Jan, is there a big difference here that people are just, is the big difference here that just people are living longer? That's mostly good news, but is that all that it's about?
It's partly that, Ann. The second half of it is that we only have one model for living it. And it was created by the leisure industry 50 or 60 years ago called retirement, where the model was really learn, work, rest, die. That worked pretty well when it was created because people weren't living as long, number one. Lots of people were working in hard physical labor, and that idea of rest, you know, was really a good thing. But now we work mostly with our minds, and we're not worn out, you know, by the time we reach 60 or 65. And what I hear most often, you know, from people who are entering into this phase of life because they've, in a way, been trained to prepare for it as the promised land, is now what?
Right. And now what doesn't necessarily fit into everybody's idea of a good time anymore.
Exactly. I mean, many, many people, it works for some, but many people don't want to just do, you know, have a life of leisure for 20 or 30 years.
Cindy Lazarus, you could have retired after being a judge, but no. You could have retired after being CEO of YWCA, but no. You have finally retired, apparently, after being CEO of Flying Horse Farms, which was a wonderful adventure for you, I'm sure, because you helped get it on its feet,
right,
pretty much. But what did you think about that next step?
You know, I had been terrified of retirement, and I think a great many people who have been active in their work lives think of that chapter in our lives is so consumed by the you know desire to do well in our careers and in our work and a real dedication to that when you think about how do I replace that focus in my life. And if all you can see is, you know, the idea of, you know, sitting in a lounge chair someplace and going, you know, just getting older. I mean, I didn't want any part of that. Retirement is still one of the worst words in the language for me. But I have discovered, you know, that this is a very different adventure than what I had feared for all those years.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about what Jan calls the third, I think. We're going to talk about that. We don't want to use the R word today. We want to use the what's next phrase, I suppose. Jan, you have a name for this time of life. Tell us about how you came to this realization, because I think it's interesting.
Well, yes, I do call it the third, because as I... You know, I had my own epiphany at about 58 or 59 when I could feel my mortality in a different way. And honestly, I'm an optimistic person. It threw me into despair. And I started looking around, looking at research, at this and that. And you know what Harvard students said about people who were 60? Mm-hmm. They said, what do you think of? And they said, wrinkled, washed up, useless. And, you know, those kind of fears of feeling useless or bored or isolated or losing my identity, you know, really came to the fore for me, too. And so I convened a group locally to talk about that and explore it and see what resonated with people and what didn't. And my friends at Ology threw in some free work. They're a great branding firm locally. And we came up with the third, because, you know, people are actually living not only to 80, but 90 and beyond. And it was a more value neutral, you know, kind of term than seniors or aging or retiring, you know, or anything like that. And like the third act of a play or anything else, you know, it's where the payoff is.
Is this a concept for people with resources, or is this a concept that can apply to a lot of people that don't have money, that don't have connections? That what does it mean for everyday people? Cindy?
Yeah, I don't think that it is, you know, kind of just the people who have, you know, estates and can travel around the world now and those kinds of things. I think the great thing is that it's a way for each of us to look at our lives and to be much more active in kind of deciding the course of those lives. And so whether it is that you have a garden that is, you know, like on your windowsill, or that you're watching birds, or that you're, you know, becoming very interested in WOSU. I mean, it is the kind of freedom and the openness of it that is available to all of us. No question that it's a lot easier to think about being open if your basic living needs are met. You have housing, you have food, you have, you know, some reasonable health care. But all of us can, you know, look at our lives and see what it is that, as we know we're moving through our last chapter, that we really would like to choose for ourselves.
Jan, for some people, the third is working more.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a choice. You know, it was Cindy Lazarus who said to me when we started having these conversations several years ago, I don't want one more one-way path. You know, I want all possibilities to be open to me, you know, as the model mm-hmm. of retirement is. And for a lot of folks, certainly for me, I want to work maybe till I drop. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And that is a good point. And, you know, in terms of it being for everyone, we also have research that confirms this that have been done with people of all socioeconomic status over 50, 60 years. And the commonality really is if we can put growth and purpose and connection into our lives, and that doesn't require money. I mean, as Cindy says, you know, yes, you know, it's tough if we're trying to put a roof over our heads, but we all have those yearnings.
I'd like to hear from some of our listeners and get some ideas about how you've maybe you don't, haven't put a phrase to it, but how you've used this third third of your life and how you've put it to work or put it to leisure or whatever it might be, whatever leisure might mean to you, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You've mentioned, Jan, that society doesn't have the social supports for this third third. Can you give us an example of how we fall short? Because we hear a lot about lifelong learning now and that kind of a thing. So where are we falling short? What kind of supports are you talking about?
Well, we just don't have the institutions or the defined roles or the trajectories that we have earlier in life. You know, earlier in life, we kind of know when it's time to start our family, to start our career, to build our career, et cetera, et cetera. And we have roles that are clear. I'm a mom. I'm a professional. I'm a worker. I'm whatever. This is, in a way, so open and with so much freedom, and our institutions haven't really defined it, which is why I know I have looked to role models, you know, for how to live it differently. One of those role models of mine will be on our panel next week at the event. Her name is Joanne Davidson.
Right.
And what I learned from Joanne was...
Former Speaker of the Ohio House.
Yes, former Speaker of the House, still very active in her mid-80s in work and still... goes
Amazing.
Up on the roof and hangs her own Christmas lights and looks great and all of that sort of thing. And what I really learned from her, because there is a danger of crossing over into invisibility. Those Harvard students were onto something about that. But what I learned from her is it's up to us now to put ourselves out there and explain, you know, to let the world see what our energy and passion is. And they still want it. They just have to know that we want it.
And we happen to be of a generation that when we look around, more people look like us than not.
Exactly.
Well, it depends on where you are. I mean, I know you just had a segment on running, and several years ago, my husband Stuart and I were running, and we went to an event that was sponsored by Abercrombie & Fitch to benefit one of the local charities. And, you know, we were surrounded by very, very young, very, very hard bodies. And so, you know, Stu and I would stand there and we would look and Stu would say, oh, there's someone in our demographic. And it would be like one other person. But I want to go back for a minute, if I can, Andy,
sure.
Your question to Jan. I think it's not only the absence of structures, but it is the kind of actively negative messaging that we receive. We receive from, you know, movies and media, magazine articles, characterizations. It is amazing how quickly you go from, you know, kind of being a titan within your field to being the person that Boy Scouts want to help across the street. And that kind of devastating loss of sense of value of others, you know, for yourself, I mean, really requires us to get much stronger about valuing and affirming ourselves and then, you know, kind of working to have the opportunities that Jan was talking about to really use those talents and the learning that we have.
Peg in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Peg.
Hi, and good morning. I retired 2 years ago. I was a music educator for 39 years. I worked 7 days a week, 14 hours a day, loved my job, loved my students, but my last 5 or 6 years, I was ready to retire. However, the way I look at it is I am not really retired. I am reassigned. I had so many things that I wanted to do for so many years that I could maybe dabble in a little bit, but not to the extent that was really fulfilling to me. And so I have really filled my life. I am busier now than when I worked. I have filled my life with volunteering. I still do some music projects. I work in my garden. I volunteer with IFI, which is International Friendships, and I've met many international students who have come to The Ohio State University from overseas. And all of these things are really fulfilling. But I think the reason it was so easy for me to be ready to retire was that I did have balance in my life before I retired.
I don't know. 14 hours a day doesn't sound like just saying, Peg.
Oh, I found a way.
All right. Working with young people helps, huh?
The international students?
Well, you were a music teacher, you said.
Oh, yes, I was a music teacher.
Mm-hmm. So, well, Peg, thanks for your call.
You're very welcome. I hope other people find value in reassignment.
Peg's a great role model. She's one of those great role models.
Right, yeah. Right. What are if someone's not sure whether they fall into this category, what should they be asking themselves about this? When? Is there a time of life you should be talking about it?
See, I think of, you know, they talk about, you know, 40 being the new 30 or,
right.
you know, whatever.
It's confusing.
I think 20 is the new 50.
Okay.
And so I think really right. thinking in terms of, you know, kind of a great openness to your lives. So you will have a period of time when you're in your 20s, your 30s, and your 40s where you are really very focused on either your career, your family, you know, kind of becoming who you are. But you don't want to get to a date in the future and then suddenly go, whoa, you know, what's next? And so I think it's a great thing. And as Jan talks about, you know, when you have the chance to interact with people outside your age demographic, you know, you learn from them and they hopefully learn from you and see that there are a lot of possibilities that will be part of their journey as well.
And I will say, Ann, it hits people at different times. And the sociology matters, too. I mean, if I'm 61 and still raising a 15-year-old, I'm probably going to have a different experience, you know, from someone who's 61 and has grandchildren
right.
now and is thinking of, you know. But you know, the world starts to impinge on us, too, a little bit. I have a friend who's a lawyer who in the last 5 years, she's 65 now, in the last 5 years, she's built a new area of practice in her law firm, brought in new clients, and they're pressing her to retire. And so, you know, because that's the way it's done. And so we still have those vestiges, too.
Right. Okay. I wanted mm-hmm. to talk about that because there's the big push thing going on, too, yes. at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's time to retire. Now, my predecessor, Freddie Enderle, did this job until he was 69 years old. There's some jobs that you can do that. Not all, or should it be, work longer?
You know, I was thinking about that because I characterize this stage of my life as I no longer work for a paycheck. So I'm not idle, but I'm not dependent on anyone to pay me in order to get me to do the work that I do. And so I probably don't feel very positively about mandatory age retirements. And I think that we lose a lot of talent that way. But I also think that it is a matter of wanting to be sure that people are making a decision based on your performance, not on what's the age, your date of birth on your driver's license. And I think it is tragic for all of us, whether we think people are too young or we think people are too old, to lose that talent on the basis of something that is very arbitrary and is lived out very differently from individual to individual.
Well, I'm looking forward to next Thursday. WOSU at COSI presents Retiring Retirement, New Paths for 50 and Beyond. It's Thursday, July 24th. It's from 5:30 to 6:30. It has a panel including Jan Allen and Cindy Lazarus, my guests today. I hope lots of folks like Peg, lots of folks that are thinking like Peg or wonder what to think about this time of life will join us for the conversation. I'll be moderating the panel. Jan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann. And to remind everyone, it's free.
It's free.
And we hope the audience will participate.
Oh, audience participation is essential, particularly if I keep losing my voice. Cindy Lazarus, thanks to you as well.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be on your show, and it's one of the best things about our community.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will continue Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Sci-fi fans will no doubt remember this scene from the 1973 classic Soylent Green starring Charlton Heston.
Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them Soylent Green is people!
Ugh. Well, believe it or not, Soylent's back. It's on the market and doing quite well, but it is not green, nor is it people. Joining us on the phone from Baltimore is licensed nutritionist and host of the Nutrition Diva podcast, Monica Reinagel. Welcome back to the show, Monica.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much.
So the product is a nod to the movie, but it's not harmful to our health. Developed by a software engineer as a kind of a meal replacement. Tell us about Soylent.
That's right. The name is a nod to a movie, but the idea really came from a guy. He's a software engineer, as you mentioned, who just felt like he was spending too much time and energy and money on food, on eating. He resented the time it took him to go to the grocery store, to plan meals, to cook, to clean up afterwards. And being an engineer, he thought there's got to be a more efficient way to solve this problem, to fuel this machine called my body. And so he spent a couple of years trying to come up with, you know, the simplest powdered formula that he could create that would cover all the nutritional bases. And a lot of the so-called body hackers kind of got excited about this and have been participating with him and experimenting to see what they could come up with and how long they could survive on this sort of powdered nutritional food replacement. And some of them have gone, you know, a month or two consuming nothing but this powder that they've come up with. And then finally, just a couple of months ago, the product went public and you can now order it online, although I understand it's been such a sensation. There's a bit of a backlog. You may wait a little for your order. Personally, Anne, I don't see the point in trying to remove food from my life. It's one of my greatest sources of pleasure in addition to being a source of fuel.
Well, it's a source of fuel, but it's also has, you know, there's different properties to different foods. And a lot of times, and when I've talked to you and I've talked to other nutritionists, it's how we consume our food, what the form of it is that gives it its greatest benefits.
Well, that's right. They've taken a very reductionist approach here and decided you don't need oranges, you just need vitamin C. And so they've put some synthetic vitamin C into the powder. And then, of course, our question is, yeah, but what else is in that orange that was contributing to your health that didn't make it into the final product? So, you know, there's always that. It's the same question with any kind of vitamin supplementation. What are you leaving behind? So that's one very valid concern or criticism of this approach.
So what, did you try it?
Well, it's backordered right now. We did. There is a do-it-yourself community attached to this movement that has posted all kinds of recipes that you can use to cook up your own if you can't wait to get your supply. And we did mix up one or two of those and tried them. And, you know, they weren't terrible, but I would miss food in a hurry, like before I got to the end of the first day, much less the first week or month.
And when you say they made it a month, was there some kind of clinical measurements taken to make sure that they really did make it and they hadn't suffered
any... Oh, you mean
any...
like that they weren't cheating?
Cheating that they weren't... Yeah, I mean, were they, you know, were they constipated? Were they, you know, were they listless?
You can go on the website, which is Soylent, Soylent.me, and quickly connect to blogs that people kept to report things like that. How were they feeling? Were they hungry? What were the challenges? But this wasn't supervised by any kind of medical team. This is completely a grassroots, do-it-yourself sort of movement. So no, nobody was overseeing how these folks were doing, whether it was a good idea, which sounds a little scary, a little irresponsible. Until you think about how long people go eating junk food.
Good point.
And then you think, well, you know, it's probably no worse.
Right. I guess I was listening to myself and I thought, I sound awful anxious and I share your love of food, apparently. I don't want this to become a trend. I don't want someone to take away my food.
Yeah, for me, it all falls apart right there because I don't resent the time that I spend preparing food. And, you know, that's what I do for relaxation. That's how I spend time with my friends and family. So clearly I'm not the target audience and probably you aren't either, but it is fun to think about. So, Anne, how much time would you say you probably spend in a typical week grocery shopping, cooking, cleaning up?
I mean, maybe, I don't know, 10 or 12 hours.
Yeah, I was going to say 12 or 15 hours, you know, include the time that you're actually eating. And probably $100-$150 a week, maybe, depending on how often you eat out. So what would you do with all that time and money if you could reduce the food cost to $5 a day and the time involved to 15 minutes a day? You know, one way to look at that is, okay, what would you do instead with that time and money?
Okay.
Gosh, I don't know. I really wrap a lot around Dee Dee. Well, the money. Yeah. And I guess there's implications for feeding the world, too.
Absolutely. Yes. So, not to mention if we ever have to get on board a spaceship and travel to a distant planet because we've rendered ours uninhabitable, this is exactly what we'd need to get us there.
Yeah, there is that. There is that ecological aspect to it as well.
Right. There's virtually no waste because this is shelf-stable. It requires no refrigeration. So it's not like the groceries, the vegetables that you buy with the best of intentions, and then you have to throw them away mm-hmm. because you don't get to cook them. It is very efficient. And I think it's an interesting exercise, but I think they've probably got a long way to go before they're going to put food out of business.
Let's switch gears here to polycystic ovarian syndrome. Something you wrote about recently, PCOS, it's a hormonal disorder that affects as many as 1 in 10 women, and it's linked to a lot of health issues like diabetes. Tell us about it.
Right. This is really kind of coming up in the public consciousness because it's becoming a more frequent diagnosis. We didn't used to see 10% of the childbearing women with PCOS, and now that's what the numbers are approaching. So it's getting our attention. And it's basically a disorder of hormonal imbalance that affects not just the reproductive hormones like estrogen and testosterone. And in fact, PCOS is one of the leading causes of infertility, which, as you probably know, is also on the rise. But it also then goes on to affect the hormones that regulate blood sugar and appetite and fat storage and can set women up for things like type 2 diabetes and heart disease and other serious health concerns. So it's definitely something that deserves our attention. And one of the reasons that we are seeing increasing numbers of this condition is that it is closely linked to obesity. Women who are obese have a much higher risk of PCOS, and as the numbers, unfortunately, over the last couple decades of overweight and obesity have increased, so have the numbers of women with PCOS. But we should just point out quickly that there are also lean women who have this condition. It's not a 100% correlation.
Now, just from listening to the sound of polycystic, that means cysts on your ovaries.
Exactly. Exactly.
What does that have to do with eating?
That's right. Well, you know, the hormones, the different hormones in the body are all interrelated, and it might seem like those reproductive hormones would have nothing to do with digestion and vice versa, but it's all a very complex interrelated system. One way that they are related, Anne, is that when we have more body fat, that we're carrying around extra fat, we have more estrogen circulating in our body. So there's a very direct correlation between eating and reproductive health.
So what kinds of things should people with PCOS be eating? Should they be changing their diets if you're bringing up type 2 diabetes?
Yeah. This is the number one line of defense against PCOS is diet and lifestyle regulation. And the main goal is to improve insulin sensitivity because this is kind of the key to the whole puzzle. And so what that ends up looking like in terms of a dietary recommendation is not necessarily a low-carb diet. We're not talking about an Atkins diet, but the best approach does appear to be a diet that is lower in carbohydrates, especially the grain-based foods. Hmm. So that would be all the better things, breads and pastries and baked goods and pasta, and even whole grains need to be consumed in moderation because that's what sort of drives that insulin response.
And vitamins or supplements, does that help?
Yeah, you know what? There are a couple of supplements that appear to be helpful. You know from our work together that I like people to get their nutrition from food rather than supplements, but sometimes there can be some therapeutic benefit. And the two that seem to have floated to the top of the tank for PCOS are vitamin D, which is the vitamin that we get from the sun, but we can also take that as a supplement. And another vitamin that might not be as familiar to you is called myo-inositol. It's from the B vitamin family. You can get it as a powder, and this helps with blood sugar and insulin sensitivity. So For example, you could add a scoop of that to a morning smoothie, and that might help. But also the, you know, the big push here, if you are overweight and suffering from PCOS, losing even a little bit of weight can make a big difference. You don't necessarily need to get all the way to your goal weight. Even just losing that first 5 or 10 pounds can have a big impact.
So it's curable with lifestyle.
Very often, yes. The symptoms can be reversed or even eliminated by getting the diet and the lifestyle and the body weight under control. And also the fertility often returns, which is, you know, very exciting and motivating for a lot of women.
When are women usually diagnosed with this?
You know, in their 20s in their late 20s, or sometimes it comes up because they're trying to get pregnant and they can't. And upon examination, it turns out, oh, yes, you know, there's some cysts on the ovaries. But sometimes women have symptoms that are like increased acne late in life, but after adolescence, when you would normally expect that to be resolving, mm-hmm. or unexplained hair growth. And those are aspects of the hormone imbalance. So it can present in a lot of different ways, but it's usually caught by your gynecologist.
Okay. And if you wrote about sugar overdosing?
I got a question from a listener who wanted to know if they slip up and they overdosed on sugar, if they ate a lot of sugar, was there anything they could do to undo the damage? And
what do you mean,
I could
slip
understand
up?
The question. I've wondered, right? Like, oops.
I wonder every single day.
I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, like if you were to eat too much salt, you could help flush that out of your body by drinking a lot of extra water. But unfortunately, as I had to tell my listener, I don't have a quick fix if you've overdone it with the sugar. I don't have a way for you to flush it out of your body, except one possible exception, and that is if it just happened, like within the last hour, a burst of physical activity may allow you to burn up some of that sugar before it actually gets cleared out of the bloodstream and converted into fat. But, you know, the occasional overindulgence, thank goodness, is not the end of the world. It's when we're eating too much sugar day in and day out that we really start to see the health effects, the negative health effects. So don't beat yourself up over a single slip. Getting a little bit more exercise is always a good strategy, but that's probably the best I've got to offer for
that. And there's a lot of sugar hidden, so just because you OD'd on that bag of circus peanuts doesn't mean, you know, and you've only done it once in a blue moon. We get sugar in our processed foods constantly now.
Yeah, if you eat a lot of processed foods, one of the hidden sugar traps that a lot of women who are really eating healthy often fall into is yogurt, sweetened yogurt, or fruit-flavored yogurt, which seems so virtuous, and yet it can have almost as much added sugar as a can of cola. So that's one thing to keep an eye on in terms of added sugar. And then the other one is the sugars that we drink in our coffee drinks and our lattes and frappuccinos and in our soft drinks or sport drinks. That can add up to a lot of sugar, too.
Real quick, you wanted to talk about a large study that was done, just published in the British Journal of Nutrition, regarding the issues of organic versus conventional. It found some significant nutritional differences between organic and conventional produce.
They did. You know, we keep analyzing this data to try to determine whether organic produce is more nutritious than conventional. Of course, it's lower in pesticides, but is it higher in vitamins? And we keep getting different answers. And this latest study concluded that, yes, there are higher levels of some nutrients and antioxidants in the organic fruits and vegetables. My question is, you know, what is the impact of that on health? I still think that eating those fruits and vegetables, whether they are organic or not, is the most important part of the equation. If organic are available and you can afford them, you might be able to get just a little bit more bang for your buck.
Okay, so there you have it. Eat your vegetables no matter what.
Eat your vegetables no matter what. That pretty much sums up my advice.
Okay. Monica Reinagle, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's always fun, Ann. Have a great week.
You too. Monica Reinagle is the Nutrition Diva. She's a licensed nutritionist and host of the Nutrition Diva podcast. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher today. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Josh Trannan, and Emily Williams, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.